Welcome to our White House Communications course. This evening, we are pleased to have Peter Baker from the Washington Post. Peter has covered the Clinton White House and now the Bush White House, and in between, he went to Russia, and he also covered Afghanistan. And so he has a variety of backgrounds and can compare for us the differences in a lot of beats. And I assume that there are a lot of differences from over this period of several years. And he is an award-winning reporter. He was he won a prize of the White House Correspondents Association for his reporting on in the Clinton administration on the Monica Lewinsky story. He broke the Monica Lewinsky story for the Washington Post. And that's actually one of the stories that I'd like to talk about. We might as well have that beginning there.
It doesn't seem very interesting, does it?
how is that story developed in a timeline on it? How long before you broke the story were you working on it? And you can just give it as an example of enterprise reporting and how threads come together.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I was covering the Clinton White House, and at the Paula Jones case was going forward. I was picked to bird dog the Jones case through all of the various court iterations. And the fact of the matter is, the Post wasn't very interested in the case. We covered it, but it wasn't something we devoted a great deal of energy to, because it was sort of it was the province of a lot of tabloid type material. Proving this and proving that was problematic, and it didn't seem like it was something that was going to shake the foundations of the Republic. Well, the Saturday before the Monica story first came out, most remember, I'm sure, there was a deposition in the case. President Clinton was deposed by Paula Jones's lawyers. She was seeking to prove, of course, that he had sexually harassed her when he was governor of Arkansas. And as part of that case, her lawyers were asking him a lot of questions about other women as well, trying to prove a pattern. The judge in Arkansas had allowed this line of questioning as long as the women had some nexus to his status as governor. Did they work for him? Were they, you know, in other words, subordinate to him in some way, similar to the way Paula Jones, as a state employee, was? One of the women they asked about, of course, was Monica Lewinsky, who was, in fact, subordinate to him at the White House subsequent to the era of Paula Jones, and we didn't know anything about this at the time. Of course, it was a closed deposition. They didn't invite us in, strangely enough. They didn't simulcast it, much as we would have liked a transcript. But there were rumblings even that week leading up to the deposition about something. And this was, of course, Michael Isikoff was chasing this for Newsweek at the time. Michael Isikoff had this great scoop, he thought, about what was really going on behind the scenes. He'd been sort of chasing this for some months, really, working with, or however you want to put it, with Linda Tripp and so forth and so on. A lot of this is very familiar territory for people, but we had heard rumors about what Mike was working on, and of course people know now that the story was killed by Newsweek, and we began chasing the vapor trails, in effect. Drudge started putting pieces of the story on the internet. I got a call home. The deposition was a Saturday afternoon. It was April, as a matter of fact. It was January. On Sunday morning, the day after the deposition, I got a call at home from the national editor saying, you know, we got to go hard on this. There's something going on. We have to figure out what's happening. Ken Starr's involved. It involves women, you know. Can you come in and work on this? At the time, our investigative reporter was Sue Schmidt. She was chasing this very hard. She'd been covering the Starr investigation, Whitewater, and so forth, Vince Foster, all of those Travelgate-type scandals, which all seem so esoteric at the moment, but were very important at the time.
They were a variety, that's for sure.
There were so many, it was hard to keep track of. FBI files, and Travelgate, and Sue was chasing hard, trying to figure out what was going on. And we only had little bits and pieces here or there, a little wisp of this, a rumor of that. So she was working at the office. I came into the office and started pushing the few people I knew who might know something. And it took us about 3 days, I think, if I remember correctly, to really sort of nail down at least the broad outlines of what was going on. And we eventually figured out that there was a woman who was, at least allegedly, had been involved with the president, and there were allegations of obstruction of justice and lying and so forth. And all of that, you know, was a story. And we wrote it, and you know, a few other stories followed.
When you're putting something like that together, is that an example of working from the outside in, that in the White House, that you're getting information from the outside, and then at what point do you go to the White House?
Yeah, that's something I'm sure you've heard of from other reporters or other people.
Sanger this
right,
you
don't.
The outside
you almost never get information directly from the White House.
Yeah.
Not anything useful. You can get confirmation from them, or you can get steered back on track if you're off track, and you can get important qualifiers or context to something that you already know. But you're almost never going to get. At least I don't always. I don't ever seem to get original stories out of the White House that everybody else isn't chasing. So the best way in stories like this, as you're saying, is to go from the outside in. Who are people on the outside who are talking to people on the inside who might know things? In this case, of course, the inside was, there were three centers of information. There was the White House and its sundry parts. There was the Independent Counsel's Office, Ken Starr, his people. And there was the Paula Jones legal team. And so we began picking at all three of them up. Know, moving our way in. There were various lawyers who were affiliated with Paula Jones's people, or lawyers who were affiliated with the White House. And eventually, when we heard the name Monica Lewinsky, we tracked down who her lawyer was. And in fact, in the end, it was the night we were going to run the story. I remember Sue Schmidt really thought she had it, and we had a meeting of all the editors, and we were discussing it, and they just really wanted to get one more source and really feel like we knew we were talking about, because her sources were not going to be named in the paper. And this is a hell of a thing to put in the paper without any named sources. You know, President of the United States doing an intern, you know, legal investigation, impeachment, blah, blah, blah. So I tracked down a lawyer for Monica Lewinsky at that point, and he basically confirmed the outlines of the story with his name attached. And so we felt a lot better about the story at that point. And even then, the editor still wanted another, you know, confirmation, and they brought in our federal courts reporter, Toni Lacey, and asked her to see what she could find out, and she got another important source confirming the broad outlines of the story. So at that point, you know, they felt they had the story well enough to go, and I called the White House and directly asked them for comment. It was Lanny Davis. You remember Lanny is a character you probably see on television from time to time, a great personality in Washington. He was the special counsel at the White House at the time. In the Clinton White House, special counsel meant scandal guy. And he was in charge of answering all of the nasty questions about fundraising. Oh, remember Charlie Tree
and
all of those fundraising,
Johnny Wong
and all those guys, I've forgotten all this. Anyway, he was brought in to answer those questions. I call him at home, and I'd forgotten the conversation, but he wrote about it in his book. And the way he tells the conversation, he says it goes something like, you know, are you sitting down? He says, yes, I'm sitting here having a drink. I said, well, you may want another. And I told him what we were going after. And, you know, he called the White House, and suddenly people were, you know, racing into the office. And Clinton at the time was meeting with, I believe it was Netanyahu,
Arafat?
I think.
It was Netanyahu, then Arafat was coming
later. Yeah,
you're right.
I think that's right. You know, and so, you know, I just think you pull him out of a meeting with the Prime Minister of Israel to ask him about his sex life. You know, it's not exactly something any White House staffer wants to do. But they gave us a comment by the end of the evening, and we ran the story.
Do you have lawyers that go over a story like that?
Yeah, we have we have employed over the years, we have in-house counsel, and they're the ones who usually go over our stories. Ironically, of course, one of the law firms we've used in the past is Williams & Connolly, which is the firm that represented President Clinton in Whitewater at the time. But our in-house lawyers went over that story and many subsequent stories. But they're very good. They don't make us take out things unless there's a really good reason.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good about that.
Do they indicate what additional things need to be done? Or
they sometimes do, but the fact is we've gone through this so many times that, you know, our editors and reporters at this point pretty much know what the lawyers are going to say and what level of sourcing they're going to want to feel comfortable with and confident that we're and how to write these stories in a way that meets our legal obligations and isn't defamatory, isn't, you know, the kind of thing that's going to get us in trouble, knock on wood.
I guess one of the areas of a newspaper that probably we don't know a lot about is where an editor comes in, say, to a White House story. And so how many editors, what levels of editors?
In that story, my goodness.
I imagine every one you have,
right? It got to the point where they had to move it to a bigger conference room. There were so many editors. There were editors from Style, editors from Foreign, Business, I don't know. The whole paper seemed to
lack of it, right?
Right, they all seemed to be
in this particular case.
That's right, right. And they all seemed to be coming to these meetings every day, photo editors, and it got to be a giant conclave. I'm sure, in fact, we had more people than the Vatican had electing the Pope. But ultimately, in a big story like this, it comes down to Len Downey, the executive editor. At the time, the managing editor was Bob Kaiser. Today, it's Phil Bennett. The assistant managing editor for national news, her deputy, and then the politics editor. That's the chain that I report to and that matter the most. But you got a lot of people around that newsroom with a lot of experience, and they'll all weigh in, especially on something so sensitive.
Mm-hmm. What was the response within the White House?
They were not happy, let's say. They were shocked. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, especially those first few days, the White House staffers that I talked to, they weren't yet in battle mode because they were so shocked. They just couldn't, you know, they couldn't believe it was true. They didn't know what to believe. They were just in sort of this stunned, fog and had no idea what to say. One of the White House people I talked to early on said, you know what, he says, if this is true, it's over. We're done. This is it. And I think that was really the sensation in those first few days, like, oh my God, it's over. This, because they thought it was true. And, you know, it turned out mostly to be true. But it just, you know, it took President Clinton a little while to get his denials down to the point where they were more convincing. And it took him a while till they got the political strategy of attacking the accusers, which then gave the White House people, you know, something to grab onto. Okay, all right, yeah, that's right. Well, maybe he did it, but those guys who are accusing him are much worse, and therefore, you know, I can put aside my own anger and disgust at what the president did, and focus my energy and my, you know, resentment toward his enemies, and make it a battle. And that's what, in fact, saved Clinton in the end, of course.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised in that first day? I remember that first day he had several interviews lined up. He had Jim Lehrer,
right.
Marl Eisen,
right.
And then he did Roll Call.
That's right.
And in all three of them, he was very different than
right.
Than one ever heard him before.
Yeah.
I can remember a time in the summer of 96 where he was asked a question after he had some good economic numbers to give. He was asked about whether he was going to back a bill that would pay the legal expenses of Billy Dale. And he just absolutely lost it. He just blew up. And because he felt that they had been unfairly treated, you know,
right.
who was going to pay the legal expenses of all of his staff.
Right.
And so one of the things you could see is that if he was accused of something that he thought was unfair, he just simply couldn't hold it together. He just blew up.
Right.
And so the odd thing about that day was there was not one of those interviews where he blew up.
Right.
Now, was that... was that important to you or to other people?
Well, he sent a real signals that day. Yeah,
yeah.
He sent real signals that day that led people to believe that there was something there. You know, somebody who has nothing, didn't do any of this stuff, would react, we think, in a different way, particularly
just
given his history
and
his, what you say. I mean, he does have President Clinton has a volcanic temper. People don't see it or know about it very much because he's very good at hiding it these days. But especially in the early days, he was very open about it. And those early interviews with Mara and with Lara and the Roll Call, they were sort of equivocal and hesitant and tentative and sort of, you know, he was trying to deny it, but he was having these games where he was using the present tense, and then so it became this game of, well, is he, you know, is he trying to, he says, there is no relationship. Okay, all right, well, you know. You know, in any other person, you say, all right, well, that's a denial. Well, not with Clinton. He chooses words very carefully. So if he said there is no relationship, he means there is no relationship at this very moment. She's not in the Oval Office. We're not doing anything right now. There is no relationship. And in fact, you know, people said, oh, you journalists, you're so cynical. How can you believe that? At the time, he later showed that we were correct in his testimony to the grand jury, where he, in fact, did quibble over the meaning of the word is. And so all of us took signals from that. I think we all took cues from that. I didn't know whether it was really true at the time. You know, those first few days, I knew it was true that Ken Starr was investigating. I knew it was true that there was an allegation that there were tapes in which Monica had talked to her friend Linda Tripp about having a relationship. We didn't know Monica from Adam. We didn't know, you know, obviously somebody could make something up. They could invent things, be, you know, fantasizing or exaggerating or what have you. I had gone to see Monica at the Watergate that before the story broke to try to find her. She'd already fled, you know. So we didn't know what to make of it. We didn't really know if it was true. It was consistent with some of the things we believed to be true about President Clinton, but we didn't really know it to be true. And I think that the nature of his reaction those first few days helped cement the idea that maybe it was true.
Mm-hmm. What is the impact on your reporting when a story like that comes out? Does the White House shut down? Or is it difficult to ever shut down a Democratic White House?
People think the Clinton White excuse me. People think the Clinton White House leaked like a sieve. This is a distortion simply because the Bush White House doesn't. The Clinton White House was more disciplined than they get credit for. It was it was not like, you know, you had to work to get phone calls returned then too, at least I did. And you could get some stuff, but you had to work on it. It was not, people had this idea that, you know, Clinton himself would call you up and leak you something. It just didn't happen. It was really, there were some program leaks, some BS leaks where, you know, Rahm Emanuel or Mike Ricci or somebody, really Mike Rahm, would call you up and say, okay, tomorrow, you know, we're going to announce that some great initiative to combat crime, and, you know, it turned out to be like, you know, $2 million for neighborhood watches or something like that. But, you know, that kind of leaking is different than the leaking over something as sensitive as the president's, you know, troubles over his sex life. And so, yeah, to some extent, they shut down. They would defer things to lawyers. And they shut down partly because they didn't want to know themselves. Mike McCurry, the press secretary at the time, took a very strong position. I don't want to know. He didn't ask. You know, remember Hogan's Hero, right? The Sergeant Schultz, I know nothing. You know, he did not want to go to the grand jury. You know, if Mike McCurry goes to the president and says, is this true, that by itself is a $100,000 question, because he's got to pay at least that much to his lawyers to go to the grand jury and explain that one moment he had in the Oval Office. And he knew that. And the history of that White House was such that everything they did seemed to result in some sort of grand jury investigation. Paul Begala, who was a counselor to the president in his second term, came on board before he started at the White House, before his first day, he put a lawyer on retainer. He hadn't done anything yet, obviously. And it wasn't that he was expecting to do anything. He wasn't forecasting that he was going to, but he just knew the way Washington was working at the time. So Mike McCurry took the position, I'm not going to know anything about this, and therefore, you know, you can't ask me anything about it because I don't know.
That is incredible. I talked to somebody who was responsible for a lot of employees who were doing just basic kind of regular work, sort of the civil service group.
Right.
And somebody was subpoenaed because she had taken a telephone message from one of the people who was under investigation who had called about his health insurance.
Right.
And so she was subpoenaed by a congressional committee.
Sure.
And
well, how about, you know, the guys who work as the president's body man, they call him, or, you know, actually less formally, they call him the butt boy.
Right.
You know, this is the kid who, you know, usually about 20, 22, 23 at most, who follows the president around, holds his, you know, notebooks for him. If he's going through a crowd and somebody hands the president something, he takes it. He's just there to keep the president moving. He gets paid, at least in the Clinton era, $25,000 a year. And this kid is brought in multiple grand jury, you know, cases to pay a lawyer who's going to charge him $500 an hour. I mean, you know, that's crazy stuff.
Yeah. Did you ever follow up on the stories of whether the people's legal expenses were paid? Do you remember at one time Clinton said he was going to pay people's legal expenses?
He never did. No, as far as I know, he didn't. The government repaid legal expenses for a number of the Clinton era people, as they have for other administrations, who were not themselves targets, hadn't done anything wrong, were witnesses, you know, the Betty Currys of the world. Although I don't remember the details, but I don't think all of them got everything back. I think still a lot of people ended up with some burden. And the president, who had promised to pay back, so far as I know, never did. Now, he may have done that quietly and not asked for attention, but I've never seen anything saying he did.
Or they could create their own little tsunami fund.
They could create their tsunami fund. He's got his own lawyer bill, I think, still outstanding.
That it gives an example of a very unusual White House story. Now, what's a normal kind of White House story that you would work on? And that was very much enterprise reporting. What about the normal day-to-day coverage of the president? What do you do for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a mix of things. Obviously, you have the day story, which is whatever the president's doing that day. He has some ceremony where he's awarding Medal of Freedom to so-and-so. He's going to Chicago to talk about Social Security. He's meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister in the Oval Office, and they're talking Mideast peace. That's the day stuff you have to do, and what you try to do is take the material they're giving you and then realize there's a whole lot more there they're not giving you, and do what you can to find out about it. These days, particularly in this White House, going through the front door, you know, is not going to be very useful. They're not going to tell you a lot beyond the official script. So you try to go through the outside. You call around town to people who might know diplomats, or in the case of foreign affairs, or lobbyists in the case of, you know, domestic stuff. People on the Hill are very useful for almost anything, in the sense that they talk. Whether they know anything, it's a different issue. And so, you know, on a day story like that, you try to gather as much material as you can. And then you try to find opportunities to get off of that track and out of that little bubble for a while and do enterprise, find ways of writing about what the president is doing or the impact of his decisions that goes beyond, you know, the daily briefing and the pieces of paper that they give you. And that's a lot harder, but it's much more critical to what we do.
Mm-hmm. When there's an opportunity that the reporters ask the president questions, either short question and answer sessions or press conferences, the wires, of course, benefit because they're always looking for, you know, what's the story right then. What is the benefit to you of a press conference?
The president or the press secretary?
No, not the press secretaries, but a presidential press conference.
Presidential press conferences are very useful, and I think they're underrated. Yes, are they about showmanship? Of course, that's some of it, and there is too much preening on the part of reporters getting up and trying to, you know, ask cryptic questions. But the fact is, I think press conferences are invaluable. I think the more Americans can see their president talking and articulating what he is thinking and how he is approaching issues, the better. And I think it's also important because I think a presidential press conference is a method of discipline within a White House. Eisenhower used to say this. He was the first one, I believe, who had monthly press conferences. You may know this. I'm sure you know this better than I do.
Well, he was the first one who had them on the record.
Had them on the record, yeah, okay. Right. But he used to say, right, that I may have this wrong, but I think Eisenhower was the one who said basically that it enforced a certain discipline within the White House because it meant he knew he was going to be asked about what was happening in Europe and German reconstruction, what was happening with the Soviet Union whatever, you know, and he therefore had to get the answers before we went out there. And the same would be true today. President Bush can't go out there without asking his team, what do we know about bin Laden? What's happening in Iraq? What's going on with Syria? What's happening in the Middle East? Where's the status of things with Social Security? So I think there's a benefit to the public, and I think there's a benefit to the White House for regular press conferences. And I think that there's a certain accountability that goes with asking questions and being forced to answer in a public setting.
What do you think that you've learned about the president as a person? Because it is an opportunity, particularly the solo press conferences that, say, go on for 45 minutes or so. You can dig down into areas that they have perhaps not thought about.
Right.
And you get to have something of a window
right.
into the president. What kinds of things have you learned about Bush, and how have you seen him change over time?
Well, I mean, I've covered him only 5 months, so I can't give a great perspective on how he's changed. But I do think he's very, from what I've seen, very confident in these press conferences he's been giving in his second term. He's more comfortable in the format. He clearly is no longer as intimidated or afraid or nervous about them or whatever he was, because he's giving them once a month, but more or less these days, right? I mean, your numbers would show that he gave virtually none, right, in his first term, very few.
Yeah, he didn't do very many.
Yeah, and now he's doing it on a fairly regular basis.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I think that's to his credit and to the public's benefit. And I think you get to know things about Bush by asking him questions that aren't the questions he's been briefed about, where you get him thinking a little bit. Or you just get sort of an unexpected answer. I asked him at a press conference shortly after his inaugural address, when he had talked about democracy promotion as his main goal of his second term. I asked him about a paper that Condi Rice had written in 2000 for Foreign Affairs magazine, which was the manifesto for the Bush foreign policy, what it would be in his presidency. And in that, she wrote, our policy is basically one of realpolitik. It's about, you know, it's about great nations like China and Russia. It's about national security. It's about missile defense and these things. No word about trade agreements. No word about democracy, practically. It was not an articulation of a forward-leaning promotion of freedom, democracy, liberty around the world document. And this was the paper that was written by his foreign policy advisor that defined his campaign's foreign policy promises. And I asked her, I said, well, Mr. President, you know, how did you get from this document to your second inaugural address, where, you know, you're going to devote your second term to confronting every ruler and every nation about, you know, democracy and freedom at home? And he kind of scratched his head and he said, well, I never read that. He said, and I have to admit, I should have jumped in with the huh, you know, the follow-up question, and I was rather stunned by the answer. He had never read it. And I think that's very interesting. You know, he had never read what was the manifesto for his own campaign on foreign policy. Now, what you can learn from that, I'll leave to everybody else to decide, but it's fairly interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. What do you get on a daily basis? We're mentioning the briefings. We've got in the morning there's a gaggle, and which is the a session that is on the record but is off camera with the press secretary, and then the daily briefing, which is televised. What do you get out of those sessions?
You get the line, the official line of the day, whatever it is that they want to say, and rarely much more. You know, the gaggles were more useful when they were not in the briefing room, I think. You know, mm-hmm. The evolution of this, of course, before 9/11, this was a time when the press secretary would basically see the reporters at the beginning of the day in his office. They'd kind of huddle around 5 minutes. He'd say, this is what we're going to do today. It was on the record. We could quote it, but it was much more relaxed and, I think, more, you know, useful. And instead, it's simply become a second, you know, second show. Mm-hmm. And instead of it being about getting information, it tends to be too much about, you know, these sort of how many angels on the head of a pin debates, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Scott, how can you say X when Y? And Scott then returns to the talking points, and he says exactly the same thing he just said 2 minutes before. Reporter B says, but Scott, in fact, isn't it so that blah, blah, blah? And Scott says exactly the same thing he said just before. And it's just everybody's playing their game, and it's not very illuminating.
Or like the other day, the issue over anonymous sources, when it was said that Secretary Powell had talked to Senator Hagel. And talked about the Bolton nomination, about Bolton. And so the White House said they're not going to respond to anonymous sources. The people are pointing out it's not anonymous.
Right.
But they wouldn't budge. It yes. still was
right.
an anonymous source.
You will never, you won't get, they're very good about that, and maybe it's to their credit to be disciplined. They don't get off message when it comes to those big briefings. So we, you know, we tend to go to the morning one just to hear what the line is, and we don't really go to the afternoon one very often. We read the transcript just to make sure we know what's going on, but they don't vary very much, and it's just not useful expenditure of time a lot of time.
One of the things they do with gaggle that was not done in the Clinton administration is there was no record, no White House record
right.
of the gaggle in the Clinton administration. In this administration, it is transcribed and it's
right.
emailed to a lot of people within the administration. And so some people have said that to them it's very useful because they learn what they can talk about and what they can't talk
right.
about.
Right, exactly. Exactly, the rules are set out. And, you know, okay, fair enough. And the same thing with these pool reports that we right now are now disseminated far more widely. And so the press secretary is less candid at the gaggle, and we're less candid in the pool reports because everybody knows they've got a bigger audience to think about.
What difference does it make to you who's press secretary?
I think it makes a lot of difference. I think that I'm interested in the way press secretaries view their own role. In the past, press secretaries, I think Marlon Fitzwater talks about this in his book, correct me if I'm wrong, but the past view of the press secretary was that they had two competing mandates. They served the president, but they also served the press and by extension the public. It was not, you know, the same thing as being a campaign press secretary. Your job as the White House press secretary, you know, you were a taxpayer, you worked for the taxpayers. You were about providing information about the workings of government, about the president and the inner circle of the White House. I think more and more, I think press secretaries view their job as representing the president and less so about their obligations to, you know, to the public to provide full and complete and accurate information.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, I was going to say, what do you expect out of a press secretary? What do you want out of a press secretary?
What I would love out of a press secretary, which we don't get, is just, you know, a fuller, more just straightforward, factual rendition of decision making and events that are happening inside the White House. And instead, what we get is a lot of spin, and that's the modern era. You know, I don't blame anybody for that, but it is the evolution of our political media culture with 24-hour cable news and the evolution of our own media sensibilities that, you know, the press secretary feels the need to just, you know, to give, you know, officially the talking points and not much else. And I want to know how the presidency works. I want to know how he's making decisions, not because I want to make it a scandal or embarrass him. I just think that we want to know, who does he talk to? What do they say? What were the factors that were going into the decisions that are made? Are there second thoughts? You know, is there a debate? Too often, White Houses, and this one in particular, acts as if the presence of a debate within an administration is a bad thing. How is that a bad thing? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't there be a debate about great issues before decisions are made? And the idea that there would be no debate, that everybody, in fact, is so monolithically of the same opinion that there would be no debate, I find actually much more disturbing than the idea that there is a debate.
The Clinton administration, even after Lewinsky, there were a lot more briefings, and they were policy briefings.
Yeah.
Why do you think that there's a difference? Is that a partisan difference towards the process of government?
Well, I think that I don't pretend to know the Bush people as well as I hope to know them at some point, but my impression is that their view of things is they got to where they are without needing the press. The old days, there was a sense that you had to play with the press because, in fact, you needed them, Republican or Democrat. You might have hated them. They might have hated you. But you had to play the game to some extent. You had to get your message out. The world's different now. You don't have to use the press to get your message out. There's a whole avenue, a whole panoply of options in front of a president or an important political figure for communication. And telling the Washington Post, the New York Times is no longer, you know, top of the list for a lot of people. The battles used to be fought out, you could argue, in the pages of the Washington Post. Policy battles were argued through the Post and the New York Times, and then by extension through the networks, which would then follow a lot of the agenda that people were setting through these stories, and I don't think you see that as much anymore.
Yeah, but you still see that. Say out in the take it as an example. Then when the president released his energy proposal years ago, I was in College Station, Texas, and I was reading the local paper. I think it was the Eagle, the College Station Eagle. And there was an article there about the energy program, and it was written by Terry Hunt, mm-hmm. Associated Press wire correspondent, you know, who does his work right behind the press briefing room.
Right.
And, you know, when it comes down to it, that the Post, you're syndicated around the country, that people all around the country are reading
right.
The New York Times and the Washington Post and AP and Reuters, Los Angeles Times. so that White Houses maybe can think that they can deal without you all. But in the long run, they certainly do need you.
That's true on the macro level, but a lot of what's discussed in the daily press, especially the Post or the Times and Wires, is before we get to that point. The details of the energy plan are really aimed at an elite audience. You know, the average person in College Station, Texas, and I'd say the average person, you know, in my hometown here in Washington or Fairfax, really is not following the ins and outs of the debate. And so until you get from, you know, they might pay attention when the plan is announced. They might pay attention if a plan is voted on and passed. And between here and there, the audience shrinks to 535 people on Capitol Hill, you know, however many people in the administration are involved. And they talk to each other through the news media. And I think they used to talk to each other a lot more through the news media than they do now. I think that, that's a different thing, too.
If they don't talk through the media, how do they do it?
That's a very good question. I think that first of all, you have a situation in this administration where right now we have same party control of both Congress and the White House. And so, at least compared to the Clinton era, when we had Republican Congress and a Democratic White House, there's an incentive for keeping the stuff out of the papers that there wasn't in the past. You know, when there are two different parties involved, then there's, you know, invariably going to be a public dialogue in that regard. When the Republicans on the Hill talk about it with the White House, they don't want to have a lot of cases in the papers. Now, that's going to change, especially, I think, in the second term. You're already seeing, you know, the push and pull and tug of war between Republicans on one side and Republicans on the other side, and some of that spilling out into the papers.
Is there also just a difference in the coalitions of the two parties, so that in the Republican Party, although you've got the social conservatives who are using a lot of out-front strategies, but that the business people, they have other kinds of strategies. They don't like to use media strategies. They'd rather talk internally and do things that way and work through compromise. Whereas, say, with Democratic groups, one person in the Carter administration talked about the interest groups surrounding them and their coalition is 100, basically 100%ers, that they want 100% of what they want.
Right.
And that they always take media strategies, often because they have very large interest groups that they're heading.
Right.
And so their people want, their members want to see them do something and hold the president's feet to the fire.
Right.
So that Democrats end up with groups that are after them in that way and use the media in that kind of way, whereas Republicans don't.
Well, that may be, and certainly in the Social Security debate right now, we're seeing that use of media, the AARP, of course, and other organizations that are fighting the president's plan are very active in their TV ads, radio ads. They are using the public megaphone. It's not a quite private debate. But on the other hand, the ultimate debate is going to be between the president and the Republicans on the Hill, you know, because the Democrats aren't going to play. So the question is, what does Chuck Grassley and what does the president really want out of this, and where do they eventually go? You know, is there a point at which they decide to pull the plug because it isn't going to work, or is there a point at which Grassley says, okay, I can give you a bill, it's going to be a Republican-only bill, and here's what it's going to be?
Do you find in what you've seen of Democratic and Republican White Houses that they run differently?
I'm leery of drawing overly broad conclusions. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this White House, the Bush White House, whether it's party, has anything to do with party affiliation, I don't know, but the Bush White House is much more disciplined than the Clinton White House. Things happen on time, things happen on the days they say they're going to happen, more or less. They don't sort of have the sense of organizational clutter that was always there, you know. And when I travel with President Clinton on a trip, you know, to go to, say, Cincinnati and talk to cops about a crime bill, invariably there would also be three fundraisers added on, and then maybe you'd go to some other, you'd go to some school in the next town over, and we'd stay three nights, and, you know, you'd get back, you know, more or less 4 or 3 or 4 hours within the time frame you said you were going to get back. Bush. He goes to Cincinnati. He gives a speech. He gets back on the plane. He comes back. He's here for dinner. You're home for dinner. You're here within 5 minutes of when they say you're going to be there. And that's it. Unless you're early. And it's a completely different mindset. Completely different mindset.
Well, let's talk about your change between the two administrations. You went to Russia. And what was it like going to Russia? You chose to go, and what were you looking for there? What did you think you'd find, and what was it like?
Well, the Kremlin has even less briefings than the White House, I can say. All the people who complain about the Bush White House should try covering the Kremlin. That's a tough place to cover. But Russia, we wanted to go. My wife is also a correspondent, Susan Glasser, and we went together as a team. And we wanted to go, you know, see a different part of the world and just explore a rather rich and extraordinary culture. Russia as a dynamic and changing society, and particularly now under Vladimir Putin, it's changing in a lot of ways backwards, heading back toward the way it had been before. We got the chance to travel across dozens of countries, frankly, over the period of 4 years, because we ended up going to Afghanistan and Iraq, like most foreign correspondents. Everybody got dragged into the those things. We didn't expect that when we went overseas. We just wanted a chance to see a different part of the world.
But did you go in 2000 or in 2001?
We had the end of 2000 and came back last November. Mm-hmm. So we
were you pretty free to figure out what you wanted to report on?
More or less, yeah, because there's an 8-hour time difference between Moscow and Washington. Your editor, by the time he gets up in the morning and decides he wants to give you a story idea, it's pretty much days over in Russia. So he has to trust your judgment. But obviously when it comes to, again, things like Afghanistan and Iraq, they were playing a much more hands-on role. Mm-hmm. That's involving things that were happening in Washington as well as the region.
What kind of stories did you particularly enjoy covering when you were in Russia? What's an example of the kind of story you'd write?
Oh, you know, I love traveling. My wife loved traveling too, going around to different places. The first trip I took in Russia was to this place called Chukotka, which is in the far, far east of Russia, just across from Alaska. And for some idiotic reason, I went in February, and it was literally 40 degrees below zero. 40 degrees below zero. Here's an interesting fun fact you didn't know. I didn't know. 40 degrees below zero Celsius is 40 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, which also just translates to damn cold. And it's just, it was an extraordinary place, all white, everywhere you could look. We saw the Arctic Ocean, and I swear to God, it freezes mid-wave, totally frozen. And my translator and I got trapped there for a week because the flights couldn't get in and out, and there is no land route to the rest of Russia. So things like that were great adventures. I love traveling through Central Asia. The Fergana Valley, where it's a hotbed of Islamic extremism, was fascinating. I got to go to Russian Mission Control to watch, them do space shots and so forth, and meet KGB agents. And I saw the revolution in Georgia, the Soviet Republic of Georgia, a year and a half ago, which led to the one that happened in Ukraine, and so forth. That was one of the most exhilarating things I've ever seen.
And how do you put together your coverage of something like that? Because it's going to be, you know, going in, this can be pretty dicey because it's a volatile situation.
The Georgia one in particular?
Yeah.
Well, that one, I was lucky enough. I had been there a number of times, and I knew all the main players, and I'd reported there enough that I felt comfortable with the general dynamics. But you don't know. I mean, you never know large crowds like that. My wife, by contrast, went to Baku, which is the capital of Azerbaijan, when there was political unrest, and she got very close to being caught up in a riot. And she was smart enough, having survived the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, to recognize when the protest was beginning to turn. There's a certain, you know, dynamic in the crowd, and the sort of the mood changes, and suddenly it's like on a movie, you know, suddenly there's quiet before the storm, right? And she said she recognized it and grabbed her translator and said, "Let's get the hell out of here." And they ran in this building and up to the 14th floor and watched out the window as the police came and just ruthlessly beat people in the street. And she had told an AP reporter who was with her, she said, "Come on, Bert, let's go, let's go." And he didn't, and he got beaten. You know, he literally paused just another 2 minutes and didn't recognize that one moment to get out. So it's partly experience. Eventually, we did take classes, and conflict zone experiences and stuff, you know, which helps
KGB?
A little bit. No, no, this was in Britain, former Royal Marines.
Uh-huh. So. Did you go to Chechnya?
Went to Chechnya, yeah, crazy place.
The first person who came to the course, we were talking about him earlier before we began this evening, Chris Morris, photographer for Time, talked about Chechnya, and he showed us some of his pictures, and he talked about going in. What kinds of things would you do in preparation for going into Chechnya? To start off with, which side would you go in with?
I wouldn't go in with either side. I went once with the government just to make sure I knew what that was like, and it was a complete waste. And they kept very tight control, and they only showed you what they wanted you to see. And you got to remember, the Russians have centuries of history of showing people what they want to see, and that was useless. So I would go in on my own or with a colleague, and we would just before we went, we knew exactly where we wanted to go, how we wanted to do it, what roads we were going to take. You know, you had to make sure you knew which roads were safe at the time, who you were going to go in with, what local guide or translator or fixer you were going to use. And you had to make sure you told your office when you were going to come out. A colleague of ours made the mistake of missing a planned phone call back to her office. And she was presumed missing, and the U.S. Embassy put out a thing saying, you know, so-and-so reporter for the American newspaper is missing, which then alerted the Russians to the fact that she was there in the first place, which is illegal. And after it turns out she was not, in fact, missing, she just hadn't called in correctly. There was a miscommunication. It wasn't her fault, really. The FSB, which is the current KGB, tracked down the fixer who took her in, disappeared him, which is a verb in Russia, and he was gone for more than a month, beaten ruthlessly. We thought he was dead. Somebody who worked with us as well, unfortunately, was not killed, but, you know, there are real consequences, so... it was something you always had to be careful of. Mm. And frankly, either side, they're both dangerous.
Well, you went from that into Afghanistan. And can you tell us about that? About the decision to go in to start off with?
Well, the...
Because you both went.
We both went eventually. I went first because everybody was focused, right after 9/11, everybody was focused on Afghanistan, and people were thinking about Pakistan as the way to get in, because historically that's how Americans would go into Afghanistan. I was based in Moscow, and so Pakistan wasn't part of my turf, but Tajikistan was, and Tajikistan is a former Soviet republic just to the north of Afghanistan. And so I thought, well, maybe I can get in that way, and just got on a plane and went down there. And sure enough, the Afghan resistance, the Northern Alliance, had some representatives in Dushanbe, which is the capital of Tajikistan, and eventually I got on a helicopter that they had and flew down into the Panjshir Valley where their rebel headquarters was based. And the hell of a helicopter. This is an old Soviet helicopter that was put together with, you know,
yeah,
shoestring and baling wire.
Kind of like the one the other day.
Oh, I mean, these things go down. In fact, the day we took off, right before we took off, we got a report that the Taliban had shot down another one, and some people decided not to go as a result. But so I was there for a while inside north of Kabul, and then the bombing started, and we spent the better part of 8 months in and out of Afghanistan, actually.
What kind of contacts do you have with the U.S. government, or is that something that your paper does, to let them know where you are?
It was very different in Afghanistan and Iraq. Afghanistan, I didn't see an American for 6 months, an American soldier or American official. I never saw them. I hung out with the Afghan rebels. We got all the information we could from them, talking to Afghan people. You know, we would be very close to fighting and so forth, but with them. Because the Americans were there only in special forces for the most part and didn't want anything to do with us. And the bad part is, therefore, they did not get their story told the way it could have been, because, in fact, the only people we could talk to were Afghans. So we never heard the Americans tell their side of the story. So when there was an allegation of civilian casualties, for instance, who do we talk to? We talked to the Afghans. The Americans wouldn't talk to us. Iraq, obviously, was different. They realized, I think, that that was a mistake, and they had this embedding program everybody's heard about. And I was embedded with the Marines, and I thought that was a lot better for everybody. I think that was better for the public to understand how things worked and to hear the voices and the attitudes and the perspectives of the people who were doing their fighting for them.
Were you surprised that the administration developed the program of embedding?
I was stunned, yeah. But, you know, look, the political calculation for them was that it made sense for them as well. And I understand that. And they forecast a short, quick victory, you know, and thought that, therefore, embedding would be useful for them. You know, to this day, our colleagues who are still in Baghdad, the only reporting they can do, frankly, is when they embed, because it's no longer safe to go around by themselves, which is a shame. And the military, to their credit, is still taking embeds, and mm-hmm. I think that's to their benefit as well. I think it explains the nature of their war to the public back home, so people understand what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take some questions. Towson, do you have a question?
I've got one. You talked about you know, being in all these countries, these war-torn zones, conflict areas. How do you deal with that when you get home? What kind of debriefing process is there?
One of my editors sent me a little brochure when I got back from Afghanistan and said, you know, if you want counseling, here it is. Great. Where were you? I really needed you. We all did, a lot of friends did this together, a lot of different reporters. We go through these things together, and we just, you know, we do what reporters do. We get together, we drink too much, and we talk about these things. But I don't think most of us don't have any professional, you know, anything like that. Although some of us need it.
Are there things that that you remember? I mean, we're embedded with troops in there. There was certainly a lot of, there would have been casualties. Are those things that come back to haunt you? You find, like, I don't know, like at night or something like that.
I'll wake up in the middle of the night screaming. And
that's because one of the people that appeared for the course last year talked about being in Rwanda and the just horrible impact that it had on him. He just had to get out, and he just couldn't. He couldn't do his work for some while.
Well, I would not want to do this as a career, a war correspondent as a career. A lot of people do, and you met Chris earlier in this course. And, you know, people who've done this from Bosnia and Kosovo, Rwanda, now Afghanistan, Iraq, first Gulf War. You know, more power to them. They're heroes, but I just don't think we could do that. I could do that. I think it eventually takes a real toll on you. And yeah, I remember some terrible things that I saw in Afghanistan, Iraq, that I wouldn't want to, you know, make my life's calling to go see, you know, and met some extraordinary people I just, I'm stunned to meet, stunned to think about to this day. The woman you might have seen in the paper who was killed about a week ago, a woman named Marla Ruzicka, was an amazing person. She was a one-woman humanitarian aid organization. She had this organization called Civic. I always laugh. It's not an organization. It's Marla. But, you know, she somehow showed up looking like a high schoolgirl in Afghanistan, and we all thought, what are you doing here? She looked like about 15. And she somehow managed to figure out the system, and she became, you know, a real hero. And she was not about self-promotion. She was not about herself. She was about helping other people. She wasn't about politics. She wasn't even so much as being anti-war. She just wanted to help people who needed help. And for her to become a civilian casualty when she spent the last 4 years trying to help civilian casualties is something that's very hard to live with.
Were you surprised when you saw her in Iraq?
No. No. Absolutely not. She was a force of nature, and an extraordinary person. And when we heard a week ago that she'd been killed, that's something hard to get out of your head.
Yeah. Do you all have questions?
I have two questions. One, how do you feel, and what do you feel like the course is going to be for Russia with Putin saying he's not going to run? And two, you talked about Clinton's press secretary saying he didn't want to know anything. And you kind of touched on George W. Bush saying he had never read Condoleezza Rice's paper. It seems like there's a lot of instances in their new administration with, oh, so-and-so, this memo, this article, and they say, oh, I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to read that memo. Do you feel like that's kind of the same thing as the press secretary, I don't want to know, I'm not going to read it? Mm-hmm. Or is that just kind of the tight clamp they've been putting on things the past couple of years?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Let me do your first question first. I would be surprised if Putin voluntarily gives up power in 2008. You know, the Kremlin is looking for a way right now where he and his group of people can keep power. Now, maybe it doesn't mean he stays as president. Maybe, you know, they're thinking about creative ways where they change the system of government so the prime minister suddenly is a really powerful person and the president's a figurehead. So he becomes prime minister and lets somebody else be president. In a bit of shameless promotion, we have a book coming out in June called Kremlin Rising. It'll be published by Scribner in bookstores near you. And it basically sort of analyzes his rise to power and how he has spent the last 4 or 5 years reconsolidating authority in the Kremlin, rebuilding the state in a way that is not a democracy and is not what people had hoped for after the Boris Yeltsin revolution. I don't think you build all that power in order to give it up. And Russia's a place where they understand that the minute you give up power, you become at risk. You know, Yeltsin only gave power to Putin after he became convinced that Putin would protect him. And the very first thing that Putin did as president was to sign a decree giving immunity to Yeltsin and his family from any prosecution from there on. And the reason why Yeltsin has stayed quiet for the last 5 years, I think, is because they had a deal in which, you know, he doesn't make any waves, you're not going to be, you know, in trouble. Right now, there are cabinet members who want to quit Putin's cabinet, but can't. They're not allowed to. And they're afraid that if they did, that they would be suffering the reprisals and retribution that Putin can mete out. And so it's sort of like the Godfather or something. You can't get out, you know. And so the idea that he would give up power in 2008, I find very, very, I'm very doubtful about.
Did you find a difference in the way the government dealt with you from the beginning of the time you were there to the end of the time you were there?
Yeah, it came increasingly closed down the longer we were there. And compared to the people who covered Yeltsin, it was you know, 1,000 times different. Reporters under Yeltsin were able to get their phone calls returned by Kremlin officials. I can't tell you how few Kremlin officials we actually ever met. Putin did one interview a year with American correspondents, so we did get to see him in that venue. But otherwise, you know, you didn't. It's not like he called up the Kremlin and said, you know, what's your reaction to what President Bush said today? It just didn't happen. They did not talk to you. And in fact, they began cracking down on people in the parliament from talking to you, too. It became, you know, we began being told that, sorry, I'm not allowed to talk to you anymore. You know, we contacted for the parliamentary elections 35 members of parliament running, I think this is right, 35 members of parliament running from the president's party, and only like one or two of them even talked to us. So it's becoming a more closed society, more fearful society. People are afraid to say something that will anger Putin and the Kremlin. Your second question on whether that's willful ignorance, that may be. That's a good question. I don't know if you have some specifics in mind, but I think that if I'm a press secretary and I don't want to answer the question, you know, not reading something helps me stay clear, right? There are definitely times where presidential press secretaries go out of their way to not know something in order to maintain, you know, plausible deniability, we used to call it.
Do you think that is true, especially in an age when the briefing is televised? Because the consequence of what the press secretary says is so much greater, and they don't have the same kind of levers they used to have of doing off the record and on background.
I have real sympathy. I have real sympathy for press secretary going on television, being forced to answer questions on a whole host of issues that they could not possibly genuinely know in any great depth, with the prospect that one wrong word, you know, and suddenly, you know, them shooting words, right? I mean, you know, if you make the wrong statement about Taiwan, oh my God, the Chinese will go nuts. If you say the wrong thing in the Middle East, you know, that's going to be a whole new policy, and you might not have even realized it was a whole new policy, you know, because some of these things turn on such subtleties, on the choice of words. Our colleague Glenn Kessler wrote a story about how the North Koreans are just adamant they want Bush to say that he has no hostile intent. Well, they've never used those words. He won't use those words. Why? Who knows? But they use other words like we have no plans to attack, we have, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the, you know, international relations in particular turn on these rather subtle and sometimes, you know, arcane, you know, nuances. And if I'm a press secretary who hasn't spent time overseas like Ari Fleischer or Scott McClellan or the Clinton press secretaries, you know, I'm going to be real nervous about making a mistake that's going to cause some real heartache out there.
And Marlon Fitzwater said that one of the things that he would sometimes do is read, he always thought it was important to start the briefing with something rather than let reporters start out. So he would often take State Department guidance because he knew that everything had been sanitized, that he was safe on anything that he read. And he did it until one day he was starting out and a reporter asked him before he started if he had any warmed over State Department guidance for them that day.
Listen, that had to stop. They were on to him.
He knew they were on to him, yeah. But he called, I think it was Gorbachev, a
drugstore cowboy, that's right. Yeah. Right. Good turn of phrase.
And, his assistant, NC press aide, had told him all week to say, and on Friday couldn't keep it in anymore. And said, oh, yeah, go talk to the president about it. Towson, do you have a question?
How would you say Bush or Clinton have conducted their press conferences that is significantly different than past presidents?
How they conducted? I think the press conference has evolved increasingly over the last few presidencies into honed messages and specific things they want to get out. They know what questions are going to be asked. They're, you know, with rare exception, we do not fool them. You know, they know what we're going to be talking about, and they go over it in great length beforehand what to say so that they can get out whatever particular message they want. Now that was true in past press conferences too, I think. But I think that increasingly it's a targeted idea, much like a campaign. You know, what is your message of the day? You know, stay on message. Don't vary too widely. Clinton would get into these things, though, from time to time, where he would just sort of meander intellectually across a variety of topics, and it would sort of shift away from where I think his advisors really wanted him to go, because he found the engagement, interesting. So there were times where he would just go on so long at press conferences that they literally had to almost yank him out of there. I remember it was like a famous like 90-minute press conference. Remember that one?
Yeah, oh, it was God. The State Department.
That's right.
And Tim McCurry was trying to tell him, two more questions or whatever, and so then he just gave up.
He just wouldn't stop.
But it certainly, that was a press conference, and there were a lot of them, that you got a sense of his mind.
Right.
And his range of interest, his depth of knowledge.
Right.
That I remember a press conference where in Eastern, where Carl Cannon asked him a question about China, and China had not been on the plate, and it was clearly something he had not been prepared for, and he loved the idea of taking a question that he had not been prepared for.
Right.
He liked the idea of talking about China, but of course if you got him on something that was personal,
right,
and that's where he really had trouble. If he was asked about any of the scandals, he really had difficulty holding it together.
Well, the other thing that was interesting about Clinton was, and I don't think it's true with this president, if you wanted to know what was on his mind, go to his evening events. And this doesn't do anybody any good now, obviously.
But
you go to the fundraisers, go to his evening events. Right. They didn't bother to script those out. They didn't give him, anything. They didn't need to. He's a pretty smart guy, and he knew what he wanted to say. But he would just sort of wander across a whole range of subjects as his sort of mind went. And it's an interesting mind. It's a searching mind. It's a inquiring mind. And so you just sit there and listen to him talk, and you would get sort of a sense of what are you thinking about these days? What is on his mind? And I remember in 97, I'd heard him talk about Bosnia at almost every single evening event. And I'm thinking, what is this about? He would translate it into everything. Bosnia was the metaphor for race relations in the United States. Bosnia was the metaphor for a society that cares about itself. Bosnia was a metaphor for foreign relations, obviously, in a variety of places. Bosnia was a metaphor for the Middle East. Bosnia was a metaphor for Europe. And And so I wrote a story, in fact, you know, about how this obviously was something that was sort of weighing on him. These troops were over there. He didn't know how to solve this rather, you know, messy, ugly problem that had dogged him from the beginning of his administration. So you got that window into his thinking patterns. I don't see that. I don't find a moment where we get that with Bush, unfortunately. I wish we had some sort of window into his into what he's thinking about.
One of them that I sometimes see is when he uses the word see.
Mm-hmm.
And you know when he said see, this is the way it is. And so when he says see,
right.
it, that you know that you're in uncharted water. And so it's I have to find it always interesting. I look for that in a speech.
That's interesting.
Is when he says the word see.
See, that's very interesting. I'll remember that. Let me write that down. That's good.
I read the news almost daily. Actually, I do read it daily. Many sources.
I try to read as many sources as I possibly can on a daily basis, and what I've noticed is it doesn't matter really how many news websites I check out on a daily basis, the news are always identical. The headlines are almost the same. I almost feel pressured to read the news in a different language in order to get the big picture or the more variety.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that the case? How does that happen? What dictates that they all become the same on a daily basis?
Well, I'm not sure that they're all the same. I think sometimes they're the same. I think I'm always surprised when I look at the front page of the Post and the New York Times every day to see that often it's really one or two stories of the same stories. That, you know, we end up ultimately picking different things sometimes. And in fact, people sometimes make great sport of writing stories about how we even interpret the same events completely differently. You know, the New York Times story will say, Bush, you know, Bush favors Social Security reform, and the Post headline will say, Bush, you know, opposes Social Security reform, because we've taken the same speech and interpreted different aspects of it and come up with different conclusions. I think if you look at the Washington Post and the Washington Times, for instance, you're not going to see necessarily the same take on things. And that's good. I think that's healthy. I used to work at the Washington Times. I think that the more voices we get out there providing interpretations on things, the better and healthier our society is. And so if we all look the same, that's not good. We should probably be trying to find ways of distinguishing our coverage so that we're you know, telling you something you didn't see in all the other newspapers. And I know that my editors wake up every morning hoping to avoid exactly the kind of conclusion you've come to, so we'll tell them to work a little harder.
What do you read? What do you read first in print, and then what do you read on the web?
Mm-hmm. I get the Post and the New York Times and the Washington Times at home, and I read the LA Times online every day, and I read the Moscow Times. That's not anybody else's interest.
No, that is, you know. Yeah, what other things do you read? Like, yeah, abroad, what kinds of things do you
read? I read the Moscow Times, and then there's a listserv produced by a man named David Johnson at the Center for Defense Information, who puts together articles about Russia from a lot of different sources, so I get a chance to see what's in different papers, because I'm still interested in Russia, obviously.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I try to read, if I got time, I try to read USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and certainly individual days you get stories from different places that come across your radar screen. The Boston Globe will have a good story, the Chicago Tribune will have a good story. I try to look at Knight Ridder, but it's impossible, there are too many, right? I do admit to occasionally looking at Drudge, because it's a good clearinghouse. You know, these days I don't think he does as much original reporting. He says so in today's paper, in fact. But he is still a good clearinghouse for what everybody else is writing. I try to look at The Note, you know, mm-hmm. ABC's The Note, which is a sort of a compendium you've probably seen in political news. I look at something called the Romanesco site, which is a press site that Poynter puts out about daily compendium of articles about the news industry.
It was a wonderful source when they over the New York Times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
and the Hal Raines.
Absolutely.
They just had internal messages that were...
Absolutely, and they print full memos from other news organizations, which we love to read. It's like a gossip page, basically, for reporters. It's pretty incestuous. But, you know, it's pretty fun to read also. And these days, it's more and more like a crime blotter. You know, what journalist is screwed up this way, what journalist is screwed up that way. But, you know...
Towson?
You said earlier that you didn't want to paint with a broad brush and the differences between parties when it comes to how the press operations are run. And I was just wondering if you think that maybe the personality of the press secretary or the president plays a larger role in how the press operations are run between each president, if that's a larger role than the parties.
I think that does play a very large role, and we shouldn't underestimate that. I didn't cover Bush 1, but some of my colleagues who did would talk about how they much preferred the days covering President George H.W. Bush to the days of covering President Clinton. Again, not because one was Republican and one was Democrat, but because they felt like Papa Bush treated them with more respect, with more openness, with more access and candor. He was, as anybody would say, a dignified fellow for the most part. And Clinton, Clinton had a real love-hate thing with the press, more hate than love, particularly in the last number of years. And then this Bush, I think, has come in with the lessons from the last two presidents, right? Being close to the press didn't help his father, right? And in the end, his father became very bitter toward the press, felt like they didn't give him a fair shake in 1992. And then Clinton obviously was pretty burned, you could argue, by the press. And so I think the current President Bush sees no particular value in courting the media. He recognizes that they have a role and that he needs to deal with them to some extent. But beyond the campaign of 2000 when he was giving everybody nicknames, I don't think there's sort of any particular any desire on his part to work very closely with the press.
One of the things that you can kind of see across administrations and it makes me think of it is George H.W. Bush, is that presidents are never wrong.
Yeah.
That
mistakes
that
were made.
That's right.
Not I made mistakes. Never I made mistakes.
They believe that, and their staffs, particularly senior level people, have to work with that fiction as well.
Yeah.
And so it's always blame the messenger. I mean, in reality, as much as his father met with the press, he really didn't have a message for what his administration was about.
Right.
At one point, one of the people who was a senior in his administration was talking about how the father believed that he did five or six different things a day and that it wasn't their job to tell reporters what their lead was, so they should just put out what mm-hmm. he did and let reporters decide what they wanted to cover.
Right.
And by the end, nobody had any idea what he stood for.
Right.
But that was really their own doing.
Right.
But
I think that's
always
right.
It's easy to blame the press.
And I think the party differences, obviously, the general perception out there is reporters are liberal and therefore they like Democrats better. Come on, give me a break. The fact of the matter is, you'll find surveys where more reporters are Democrats than are Republicans, fine. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't do us any good as reporters professionally to be pro anybody. It's our job to get out there and ask tough questions. And I think the inherent institutional relationship between the White House Press Corps and the press secretary and the president is pretty close. It's pretty consistent across parties and is dependent on the personality of the president or the press secretary and the personality of some of the members of the press in any given era. Ari Fleischer, in his book, obviously goes on to talk about how reporters are too liberal because that's what he says, but he also makes the point more accurately, in my view, is that reporters are biased toward conflict. That's a fair point. That's exactly true. Conflict is news. Conflict is what we write about. And so, we're going to be tough on Democrats. We're going to be tough on Republicans. I remember the day that Joe Lockhart, who was one of President Clinton's press secretaries, got so angry at me, screaming at me, that he kicked himself out of his own office. I was left sitting in his office not knowing what to do. He said, this article is so bogus, and if you don't see that, then, I have nothing else to say to you. And he just got up and left. And I didn't know what to do. And not that I didn't, I like Joe a lot. We got along. It didn't stop us from having a good relationship. But
do you think that Joe in particular was a good barometer of the president? Because he was there during impeachment,
mm-hmm.
and you could tell what the president was thinking by what he was saying.
Well, Joe was emotional too. Joe cared, which I like. I like the fact people care. And you could, how was Joe in a crabby mood? You know, maybe the president was in a crabby mood, or it was a bad day. It was Joe in a buoyant, mood. You could sense that things were going better for him.
And in a way, you can see, say, in the difference between Ari Fleischer and Scott McClellan, that that Scott is more a barometer of, of the president. He sees the president every morning and talks to him about what he's going to be doing that day. And so he's more of a reflection of that mood. He's a very mellow guy. And if he's all torqued up, then you can be pretty sure that it's the president.
I think that's
Ari, he didn't have that same kind of...
He didn't have that relationship with him going back. That's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
Let's see, we're here for questions. Any women? Yeah, there.
I have a couple. All right, first of all, did you foresee the media circus that came out of the Lewinsky case? And if so, do you think that all of the media coverage was a response to public outcry or vice versa? And then also on other subject, you talked about being embedded in Iraq, and you said that you thought that was a good thing for media coverage, but didn't you think did you think that hindered the reporting in some ways, that it obstructed, that it made a more narrow view of the way that we saw it?
Two very different media circuses. I think I knew that the Lewinsky was going to be a circus. I don't think anybody quite got what it would turn into, you know. I mean, very, very early on, we knew that the I word was going to be an issue. Would it lead to impeachment? Who knew? We didn't know it would necessarily lead to a trial in the Senate and all that kind of stuff. But this was the beginning, really, of the omnipresent influence of the 24-hour cable networks and the advent of the Internet. These things were new, really, at the time. I mean, CNN had been around for years, and they covered the first Gulf War and so forth, but we had never gone through a sort of wall-to-wall political scandal, you know, nonstop, on with all these channels and all this airtime to fill, and all this pressure to put out information, the latest in this investigation, all of which was, by the way, you know, a lot of it secret grand jury material. And people say, oh, there were leaks left and right. This was not, in fact, that easy to find out what was really happening. And a lot of people, you know, would take bad information, put it on the air, and we were forced to figure out whether it was true or not. And there were rumors everywhere, and everybody, you know, there were a lot of people playing games and so forth. And we finally made a decision at the Post, and I think other organizations probably made the same decision, that we would not put in the paper anything that somebody else had reported unless we confirmed it ourselves. We would give them credit. In other words, if Fox News first reported something like that, I would say that Fox News first reported da-da-da-da. But I wouldn't put it in the paper unless I knew from some source that I talked to that it was true. At least that, you know. It was through the New York Times. I wouldn't reprint New York Times scoops on the Monica thing without knowing from somebody that it was true. Not that I didn't trust the New York Times. Because on any other thing, we would print the New York Times reported today, even if we didn't necessarily have an independent corroboration. But this became so difficult, so controversial, so delicate, so easy to get wrong. We didn't want to be wrong, that we imposed a different standard. And this is also, again, the beginning of the Internet era where things were instant. The very first stories the Washington Post ever wrote during the day on its website were Monica-related stories. We had never done that before. Today we do it all the time, right? You click on the Washington Post, you'll see, you know, such and such happened in Iraq a half an hour ago, right? You click on it an hour later, you see president nominates new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or whatever. We didn't do that at the time. We didn't know how to do that. And we were forced into this environment in which, you know, oh my God, Drudge or ABC has on its website, or so-and-so says that there's a blue dress, or there's not a blue dress, or there is a blue dress, you know, or there's cigars, or they're not cigars, and oh, I can't even tell you how many, you know, women's names were thrown out there, you know, and I got to the point where, you know, I once wrote down a list for my own edification of all the women that Clinton had been linked to in the printed or internet press or on the air and TV, because I just couldn't keep track. And I wanted to know what we knew about each of them so that we didn't print something that we didn't know for ourselves. And so I find it was like a list of like 35 women or something like that. And whether it speaks to Clinton or not, it spoke to the media, because all these women's names had been aired someplace, many of them absent real evidence or absent real confirmation. And so it became very difficult. And we were very adamant on not printing, particularly on the women, any women other than what we knew was involved with the legal case that was, you know, at issue. And you had a second question. I'm sorry, real quickly.
Can I ask you something there? Your story went up at 11:30 at night, and so people at the White House who had stayed, you know, after Netanyahu had been there late, and so they stayed at the White House to read your story.
Right.
And did you hear anything after it went up?
Yeah,
did you hear
I got phone calls.
11:30?
Yeah, I got phone calls. We were there till 2 or 3 in the morning,
uh-huh.
And we got phone calls about the first edition. I can't remember exactly, but I think we even got an updated comment between editions because of what was on the web. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think that's true. And I remember walking home that night at 3 o'clock in the morning. I live in DuPont at the time, and I was walking home at 3 o'clock in the morning basically, holy crap, what is this? What happens now? And I had no idea. And it was a very scary thing because it was so dicey, and nobody wanted to. You know, and it was so uncomfortable. The press, you know, it's a press love a sex scandal, yeah. But the press doesn't really want to get into somebody's private life, at least not the mainstream press, the Post and the New York Times. We're very skittish about this stuff. They're, you know, New York Post, great. Full guns blazing. They got no problem with it. Good for them. We're a little skittish. You know, we had this whole story reported out about Bob Dole's extramarital affair in 1996 that we never ran. We did the same thing for at least two other politicians I can think of. We researched and came up with all the story, and in the end pulled back and said we don't want to touch this. And the thing that made the Monica thing different, just to answer, you know, it was not just because we wanted a media circus or because it was sensational, but because there was a federal investigation by an appointed prosecutor with a budget who didn't answer anybody, involving a lawsuit in which the president had been accused of sexual misconduct, and he chose to respond to legal requests in the way he did. He himself ultimately admitted that he essentially did not tell the truth under oath. So it was a very complicated and difficult story. What were we going to say that was relevant without being titillating? And anyway, second thing, embedding. I'm a fan of embedding for the following reasons. One is we spent the last 30 years in the press begging to be allowed to be with soldiers during war. And so finally the Pentagon says, okay, you can be with soldiers during war. So then we're going to turn up our nose and say, no, sorry, we're above this, this isn't right. You know, no, I think that's not the way to go. The way to go is to not rely only on embedded reporters. Are the embedded reporters only going to have the point of view of the troops they're with? Yes. That was true, by the way, in World War II. That was true in the Civil War. That was true in every war we ever covered, Vietnam. Does that mean that's the only thing the newspapers and TV should rely on? Of course not. Of course not. The Washington Post had about 10 reporters who were embedded with the military in Iraq. The Washington Post also had about 10 reporters who were not embedded with anybody, who were what they called unilateral, one of whom was my wife. They went around Iraq reporting on the other parts of the story that you didn't see from the vantage point of the Marine unit. My wife went to Basra and wrote about the civilians who were not greeting Americans with flowers and candy. She wrote about the Iraqis who, for the first time in 25 or 30 years, were able to speak freely and talked about the great tortures they had suffered under Saddam Hussein. She came very close to being, you know, caught up in several riots and mobs and so forth in very dangerous situations. But it was important to find people who would, and we had reporters who were in Baghdad during the war part of the war, right? Who were there as American bombers were bombing, and wrote about the Iraqi point of view of what was happening, wrote about civilian casualties, wrote about, you know, what the Iraqis felt. So would it be right to have only embedded reporters? No, you're right. We would have a way too narrow a point of view. But does that mean we don't have embedded reporters? That would be silly. We should do it the way we do politics. We send reporters to the Republican convention. Do we expect reporters who are writing from the Republican convention to have a lot of Democratic voices in the story? No, of course not. But you also send reporters to the Democratic convention. And you hope that the aggregate of the coverage gives people, you know, a lot of different points of view to consider.
Weren't there some kind of restrictions?
There were. Well, the restrictions, if you were an embedded reporter, you had to sign an agreement in which you basically agreed not to give away information that would compromise operational security of the unit you were with. You couldn't write in a story that the X brigade of the so-and-so, you know, division plans to attack Najaf tomorrow. Okay, I'm okay with that. I don't think that's a bad problem. You know, I don't think that's a real issue. I don't want, by the way, as an embedded reporter, to tell anybody that the unit I'm with is going to be attacking Najaf tomorrow, because I don't want the enemy to be there and know that. So we have a self-interest as well. So yeah, were there some restrictions like that? Yeah. But were they reasonable? I thought so. The question is, how are they implemented? How are they put into place by the military officers? The ones I dealt with were professional. They never abused it. Never abused it. Now, were other reporters in worse situations? Maybe. I don't know. But the reporters I talked to, most of them felt like they were dealt with professionally by the military guys that they were embedded with and able to report things that the military didn't want them to report. My colleague Bill Brannigan wrote about how they shot up and killed a lot of civilians coming up to a checkpoint. He listened to the whole thing on the radio as it happened, quoted everything they said, quoted the soldiers saying, you know, oh my God, we just killed all these people, wrote about it in the next day's paper, had to still live with these same soldiers, and did. That's his job, that's what he did. And the soldiers said, you know, we didn't like the story, but we believe you dealt with us fairly. You told it the way it actually happened. And in fact, because he was there and told the way it was happened, we didn't have 18 different versions the next day in which people who were not there were trying to tell us what happened. So witnesses on the ground, 600 American reporters and British and other reporters, witnesses on the ground to what happened helped prevent a lot of misunderstandings, I think.
Did your wife have any particular trouble because she's a woman?
In some places, in part of Afghanistan, she had a real problem as a woman. In one particular place, in all of Afghanistan, they don't look at women, obviously, very the way we want them to.
As equal partners.
In fact, they basically, the attitude toward Western women was, any Western woman was by definition a prostitute. But that worked in their benefit to some extent, because they didn't actually hold Western women to the standards they held their own women to. So you didn't actually have to go as a woman wearing a burqa, for instance. And they didn't, you know, most of them anyway, did not, you know, apply the same standards to you. That men would talk to Western women who would never talk to an Afghan woman they didn't know, for instance. So to some extent, my wife had an advantage, because she could talk to Afghan women. I could never talk to Afghan women. It was dangerous to talk to Afghan women. You would get shot. The few times I got anywhere close, it was very scary. I had one friend who almost did get shot for talking to an Afghan woman.
Would that be true in the countryside as well as the city?
More so in the countryside. More dangerous in the countryside. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, again, my wife did have problems in Jalalabad, in Afghanistan in particular, where men were very, some of them very ugly, you know. And there was one warlord who tried to buy her, and another one who tried to make her his fourth wife and that kind of stuff. I think there was one guy who was bargaining with a translator for how much to pay. But, you know, my wife would never let anything stop her, and it would not be a problem. She actually blew past checkpoints in Afghanistan with great bluster, and they just didn't know what to do. A woman telling them, you know, and she just, you know, say, you know, I'm going in there, period. They're like, okay, because they're scared of women. They don't know the whole thing about the Afghan sexual mentality of particularly in the countryside of Afghan men is very, very scared of women, because they don't understand a Western woman in particular.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.